This week, Democratic Attorney General Dana Nessel is asking for an investigation into possible election tampering by her presumed opponent. Governor Gretchen Whitmer will not have to testify in her lawsuit to invalidate the state's 1931 abortion ban. And a controversial DeVos-backed petition campaign turned in signatures to extend tax credits to help fund private school scholarships in the state. We are going to dig into all of these stories and much, much more today on a stateside special, spending the entire hour wrapping up the news, the political news in Michigan this week. This is Stateside. I'm Zoe Clark, in today for April Bear. Joining us now is Lauren Gibbons, Capitol reporter at Bridge, Michigan. Hi, Lauren.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Of course. And Zach Gorchow, publisher at Gongware News Service. Hey, Zach.
Hello, Zoe.
Hey, hey. And Clara Hendrickson, reporter at the Detroit Free Press. Welcome, Clara.
Thanks. It's so great to be here.
Oh, it's so good to have you three here on this beautiful Friday in Michigan. It is a gorgeous, gorgeous day. Guys, I want to dig in. And Zach, I'm going to start with you. Democratic Attorney General Dana Nessel made news this week, right? She is asking for an outside prosecutor to take over an investigation into allegations of election tampering. The reason for the outside investigation? Because one of the targets is her presumptive, and we will talk more about why I am saying presumptive later in the hour, her presumptive opponent on the November ballot. That is Matt DiPerno. Zach, this is quite the story. What is being alleged?
It basically comes down to this idea, going back to the 2020 election, and those who were most convinced, all evidence to the contrary, that the election was stolen for Joe Biden. These are the sort of Trump dead-enders who insist that there was wrongdoing that led to that result. There's just simply no evidence of it. We should state that from the top, but that hasn't stopped this crowd from believing otherwise, or at least saying they believe otherwise. And so you've had a few folks, Matt DiPerno among them, who have gone into some very red counties and you could say bullied or pushed, pick the verb you want, to get some township clerks to try to hand over tabulators that counted the votes, because this is the theory, again, totally disproven, that tabulators were somehow cooked to provide votes to Joe Biden that didn't occur. We can get deeper into that if you want, but that's really what is in question here. And it is not legal for non-election officials to possess a tabulator. And there is now evidence that Matt DiPerno and some of these others were involved in some cases, some successful efforts to acquire a tabulator or tabulators even. And so that's what's in question here. And that is why Attorney General Nessel has requested the Prosecuting Attorneys Coordinating Council, I believe is the organization, to pick a special prosecutor to investigate.
Okay, so I want to turn to you, Lauren. As Zach said, there appears to be evidence, including some actual imagery of Matt DiPerno, again, the presumable candidate for attorney general, actually in the possession of a tabulator. What other tabulator? What other evidence is there here?
Yeah, and just want to give a shout out to Craig Mauger of the Detroit News, who did some great reporting on this as well. This is, there's this ongoing investigation. There's that picture that's been going around of a voting machine. The investigation, claims that they gained unauthorized access and compromised tabulators. They allegedly gathered information from these machines that later appeared in some of the court documents that Matthew DiPerno submitted in the failed lawsuit over results, questioning the results in Antrim County. And I think going back to what Zach said, you know, these lawsuits, these allegations, none have held up in court. You know, and we should also say that thus far, Matthew DiPerno has denied the allegations, but he has also really thus far, you know, he's really trying to connect this to Attorney General Nessel and paint this as a political attack. You know, and we're also certainly Attorney General Nessel in the process of trying to request a special prosecutor is trying to separate herself with this conflict of interest. But we're seeing DiPerno really, you know, trying to connect it back to Nessel and say that it's a political motivation. But, you know, we're seeing a lot of interesting evidence and the special prosecutor, it could take a while before one is selected. And we got to wait and see what they say. But this is going to drag out for a long time.
Clara, there are more than half a dozen others involved, not just Matt DiPerno. Who are some of them?
It's a great question. So apparently, DiPerno was part of this 9-person team in this alleged conspiracy to unlawfully access voting machines. And there's sort of two key groups here. There's DiPerno, who allegedly was coordinating with State Representative Dare Rundon and attorney Stephanie Lambert Huntilla, who is one of the attorneys involved in that lawsuit, along with Sidney Powell, to overturn Michigan's election in 2020. And that group of three, according to the AG's office, orchestrated this plot to access the voting machines. And then those machines were turned over to a team of four that apparently broke into the tabulators and conducted their own quote unquote tests on the machines. And a lot of those experts, or quote unquote experts, basically created all these reports that were used to bolster this false claim that it was a technical error in the voting machine that was switching votes from Trump to Biden. There's no evidence of that. That is a claim that's been totally debunked. But a lot of those reports were filed in support of Matt DiPerno's lawsuit in Antrim County, which has really gone nowhere. But it sort of added fuel to conspiracy theories about the voting machines that have been debunked. So it's sort of this team that has been involved not only in Michigan, but also in other states where we've seen efforts to question the election results, like Doug Logan, who's the CEO of this now defunct Cyber Ninjas group. He helped oversee the so-called forensic audit in Arizona. So it's it seems like there may have been some sort of effort here with the bringing in this national group that's, you know, we've seen them in other places since 2020 crop up and, you know, fan the fuels of some of these conspiracies.
We're speaking.
If I could just jump in on this, Zoe, just to understate how absolutely out in fringe land this idea that tabulators cooked votes is. If the Trump campaign truly believed that the tabulators in Michigan or in some places were rigged for Joe Biden, he could have requested a hand recount of the ballots, in which the ballots would have been counted by hand and not the machines. And that did not happen. So, you know, this is really out there is probably putting it kindly. They had an opportunity to have the ballots counted by hand to take this out of the hands of the machines, and they did not do it. And that, to me, says a lot.
I want to get to the fact, too, about this idea and the ability for folks. Now, again, this all happened after the 2020 election, this getting into the tabulators, right? But I want to get this. I can't wrap my head around the fact, this ability for folks, outside folks, to get access to tabulators and machines like this. Is that rubbing anyone else the wrong way?
I think for me, the thing that I keep coming back to is whether or not some of these allegations underscore the vulnerabilities of Michigan's decentralized election system. I think we have one of the most decentralized systems in the country where elections are run by local administrators and some small communities who may not have the resources or the staff or the deep expertise in Michigan election law handle a situation in which they're being approached by someone who's claiming to have the authority to carry out an investigation and seizing a tabulator. And so I am thinking about the possibility that whether bad actors are operating at the local level or not, just that some people may not have understood that they weren't supposed to handle tabulators over to people who should never have had their hands on them.
And I think that's what I'm also just trying to understand, that in some of these more rural communities, right, a sheriff or maybe even a state representative can come in, as allegedly happened, and say, hey, we've got this investigation, hand over the tabulators. Again, I want to thank you, Lauren, for bringing it out. A big shout out to Craig Mauger of the Detroit News, who's done some really deep reporting on all of this. So, Zach, when I spoke about Matt DiPerno earlier, I said he is the presumptive Republican nominee for attorney general. That's because although he was endorsed at the party's April convention, he still needs to be formally nominated. That's scheduled to happen in 2 Saturdays from now. I think there's some talk, right, that with this investigation, is this nomination really going to happen? But it would take a lot to change who the candidacy is going to be at this point for the Republicans, no?
That's correct. I think some talk is, maybe among like those of us sort of in the Capitol crowd, mm-hmm. politicos, just sort of wondering, will they really go forward with this? But I think the answer is yes. There's no organized campaign to try to undo the endorsement. You need a super majority to do that. It's somewhere in the neighborhood of like 70 to 75% of the delegates would have to agree to undo the endorsed convention. Nobody that we know of is mounting any type of a campaign to try to usurp DiPerno as the endorsed nominee. And, the idea that someone's going to show up to the convention randomly and sort of be drafted is pretty fanciful. DiPerno did win among the delegates. There is a new group of delegates that will be seated, but there's nothing to indicate that the delegates that show up to the state convention will be, ideologically or philosophically any different. In fact, if anything, they're likely to be more mm-hmm. In that kind of DiPerno mm-hmm. Hard right mold. So I would be pretty shocked, to say the least, if he is not officially the nominee in a little less than 2 weeks.
And Lauren, I want to get to that. In fact, what Zach is saying, that in some cases, this might actually, this investigation, this call for investigation by Democratic Attorney General Dana Nessel, again, to an outside prosecutor's group, that this could actually help him among some real kind of extreme conservative Republicans, no?
Yeah, so that is true. There is at least some indication that there have been Republican delegates who are, more excited to cast their ballot for DiPerno. We're also seeing DiPerno himself fundraise off mm-hmm. of it. Again, going back to what I said about him claiming that this is politically motivated, that this is an attack on Republicans. And certainly some Republicans will likely be amenable to that message. And as to Zach's point, we really just haven't seen any coordinated attempts to, perhaps some grumblings have been going around, but certainly no organized attempts that would provide the supermajority necessary. And then you would start hearing from the DiPerno camp, the DiPerno supporters, these delegates who are more galvanized after this investigation announcement, that they would take some umbrage to the suggestion that someone who hadn't been endorsed months ago should now be the official nominee.
Clara, I want to go back to sort of Matt DiPerno talking about how this is so, you know, quote unquote, politically motivated by his opponent, Dana Nessel. She came out with this investigation, but as we've noted, said she doesn't want to use her office. What is she asking for instead?
She is asking for, I should say her office is asking for the Prosecuting Attorneys Coordinating Council, which is an autonomous entity within the Attorney General's office, to appoint a special prosecutor in this case. And from my understanding of the process, it's like a little bit opaque. It's not like there are clearly spelled out rules for how this is going to work on the council's website. But we did talk to a spokesperson who said that in complicated cases in the past, it's usually taken up to 60 or 90 days, which could punt this investigation until after the election. We might not even have a prosecutor appointed in this case until after November, which is kind of interesting. And one of the things that I'm sort of wondering is, typically in these cases, it's county prosecutors who would get assigned. And does the appointment of a Democratic prosecutor here kind of add fuel to claims that this is a political investigation? And then at the same time, you have maybe a Republican prosecutor, if they're appointed, wondering what this is going to mean for their political future in the party, where we have a very vocal base that has kind of rallied around DiPerno. But one thing we're not really seeing, at least as far as what's come across my radar, maybe Zach and Lauren have seen different things, but I'm not seeing a lot of other Republican candidates really coming to defend DiPerno. Christina Caramo is the one exception here, but I reached out to Tudor Dixon's campaign about, you know, what they think about the allegations against DiPerno. I haven't seen any statement from her coming to DiPerno's defense here.
That's a good point, Clara. There was really an effort prior to the primary to have some unification between legislative Republican leaders who did not support Matt DiPerno, in fact, probably aggressively opposed him at the endorsement convention mm-hmm. in the spring. But to show that, you know, they started endorsing him and saying, we support him, it's time to unify. But you're right, we haven't seen, you know, top legislative leaders, incoming legislative leaders, who in the past have shown no hesitation to criticize Dana Nessel as the Democratic Attorney General. They have not done that. And, they were pretty vocal in saying they thought Matt DiPerno was a liability back mm-hmm. in the spring before all of this really hit, that there was a good chance he'd be under some type of investigation. That his track record as an attorney was ripe for the Democrats to really hammer. And you're right. Other than the Michigan Republican Party, there's really been no, circling of the wagons, rallying mm-hmm. from other top Republicans for Matt DiPerno.
And so if someone is listening to you, Zach, and going, then how did he get it? I mean, Lauren, maybe you're going to jump in and say this exact same thing. Two words, right? Donald Trump. There was no support, but he was endorsed by the former president.
Yeah, I was actually just going to add to that point. I asked Christina Caramo about this the other day during a press conference, and even she said, if the evidence is provided that even if someone who I support has broken mm-hmm. the law, then absolutely I would support any necessary measures being followed. Now, she followed that up with similar lines of this being politically motivated, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, even she's saying if this comes down to an independent prosecutor saying that there's some merit here, you know, perhaps it's got to go down that road. So I just thought that was an interesting point that Clara made there.
Mm-hmm. And I want to talk in a few minutes, too, about a press event that the Secretary of State presumptive candidate Christina Caramo held this week that you were at, Lauren. But I really don't want to skip over, and we just very quickly talked about State Representative Dare Rendon, who is part of this. I mean, a sitting representative who seemed to wear a QAnon pin to the Capitol before. She was one of the representatives who tried to enter the Capitol on the day Electoral College votes were happening back in 2020. Zach, it sounds like she's going to keep her committee seats in the House. What is her role in all of this, and how is she sort of perceived in Lansing right now?
That's a very good question. I mean, I think if you look among sort of the permanent class in Lansing, which would be the lobbying forces and legislative staff, I don't think she's really seen as anyone who's much of a factor. And not to get too off the path on it, but, you know, she chairs the insurance committee and has actually tried to look at some changes to the auto no-fault law and has seen her Republican colleagues really rebuke her on that, even walk out of meetings. So I don't think, you know, those two things aren't related. The elections and the insurance law, those aren't related, but I don't think she's seen as someone of great import in terms of her role in the legislature. But, you know, I think there is real concern about, you know, her activities. You know, she was at the forefront, as you mentioned, among members of the legislature trying to, you know, usurp the results of the popular vote in Michigan for president in 2020. The QAnon pin certainly turned a lot of heads. And now, you know, there's been, you know, reporting, Lauren mentioned Craig at the Detroit News, that, you know, she was among those trying to push, allegedly push local clerks to hand over tabulators. And, you know, some of these township clerks, Clara made the good point about how balkanized our election system is. You know, they're, you know, a township clerk, you know, maybe they've got 100 voters, if that, in their jurisdiction. These are small, small communities. And if a state representative is knocking on your door, you know, I think all of us think of a clerk as someone of like a, you know, major official. But if you're a township clerk in a township of 100 people, you know, you don't, you know, maybe carry the same, you know, you don't carry the same weight as a county clerk or someone who's the clerk of a community of 100,000 people. And so you're going to feel some pressure to respond to that. So it's been fascinating to see Dara Rendon emerge as sort of one of these leading figures in this investigation.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's, I guess, keep talking a little bit about election denialism. Lauren, Christina Caramo, the Republican running for Secretary of State of Michigan, right? She held a press event on Wednesday. This was after her Twitter account posted a link to another social media post on Truth Social that said, among other things, that Donald Trump will, quote, be back in the White House before the end of the year. Now, claiming Donald Trump won the election in 2020, which he did not, is nothing new for Caramo. What was new, however, is that after that post happened, she said that her Twitter account was hacked and that that's why it was posted. Lauren, you were at this press conference. Can you just fill us in on what is going on here?
Yeah. So, and also props to MLive reporter Simon Schuster, who screenshotted the True Social post that initially was tweeted by Caramo's account here. Now, it's very interesting because I asked Christina Caramo, you know, if she denied the claims that were made in this True Social post, which did claim that Trump won the 2020 election and that he would be back in the White House before the end of the year. Now, she didn't quite elaborate on which parts were nonsense, but she said that they were nonsense and that she wouldn't have said that or wouldn't have posted that when she was asked about it. And she alleged that a reporter had contacted her team about this tweet and said that she said that she hadn't been aware of it. Her team hadn't been aware of it. So, and her quote was, that showed me that my Twitter had been hacked. Now I asked about, you know, what, if anything, what measures had been taken or, you know, if there had been any look seen into, you know, if there was a hack, what happened? And she didn't elaborate too much, but she said that the team would now take additional measures to make sure that her social media accounts were more secure moving forward. But this was the only tweet that had come out, you know, during that time. Like, she had posted a live video, and then there was this tweet, and then it was, my account had been hacked. So it was just the one tweet that we're looking at here. And also, you know, it, I think perhaps the, allegation that Trump could potentially take office again, before the end of the year, which is not true. Perhaps that would be new, but certainly Karamo's record, it indeed her rise to prominence was based on allegations of fraud in Michigan that have just not panned out during investigations from elections officials, from state lawmakers, from, just folks across the board have looked into these allegations extensively and have not found them to be true. So certainly, perhaps this Truth Social post that came from her account, went a little further than some of her statements in the past. But, she's long alleged that there was fraud in the 2020 election.
Clara, what do we know about Christina Karamo? Who is this candidate who is running to be the Republican candidate for Secretary of State, the overseer of elections here in Michigan?
Sure. So Christina Karamo is a community college instructor in Wayne County. And she really rose to prominence after the 2020 presidential election. She was sort of boosted and embraced by conservative media, appearing on Fox News multiple times as an election fraud whistleblower, saying that while she served as an election challenger in Detroit, she witnessed fraud. I've taken a close look at some of her allegations, and there's really no there. And it sort of falls in the category of misunderstanding basic election processes and confusing them for something nefarious. I mean, she received Donald Trump's endorsement last fall and really easily won the endorsement at the Michigan Republican Party convention in April. She received nearly 70% of the vote. I think she's sort of been embraced as the key Trump-endorsed candidate here, but she doesn't have experience working elections, with the one exception of serving as a challenger in 2020. It'll be interesting to see sort of how she positions herself in a general election coming out of the convention. She made a pretty strange claim at this press conference that Lauren was at this past week. For someone who's running as the state's chief election official, she indicated that she doesn't really understand current voter ID rules. She was speaking out against a proposed constitutional amendment to increase ballot access and said that the proposal would eliminate the provisional ballot option for someone who doesn't show an ID. And there is no provisional ballot for someone who doesn't show an ID. That person's still allowed to sign an affidavit, confirm their identity, and vote normally. So there's some just sort of basic processes that she's indicated she doesn't really understand for someone who's running to serve as the chief elections official.
And we should note, Zach, this is something that's happening nationwide, right? Election deniers running for statewide office.
Yeah. And just to underscore how extraordinary this is, I mean, traditionally, the Republicans would nominate a county clerk or someone, with some experience, pretty high level experience for Secretary of State. But no one wanted to do it this year because they knew they would get caught up in election. Why weren't you doing something about election fraud? Yeah. And so it really ended up leaving the field empty and, open for someone with a Trump endorsement who favored election denialism to win it.
Yeah.
And that's what happened.
Exactly. We need to take a quick break here. Coming up, we're going to continue our conversation about all the politics throughout the state that happened, including this week, a controversial DeVos family-backed proposal turned in signatures on Wednesday. What the proposal would do, that is coming up.
Support for the Stateside Podcast comes from the University of Michigan's Go Blue Guarantee, committed to keeping a U of M undergraduate education within reach of all Michigan residents, regardless of socioeconomic status. Programs are available for all three campuses. More at goblueguarantee.umich.edu.
Support for Michigan Public's Stateside Podcast comes from Lake Trust Credit Union, working to empower financial well-being for Michigan consumers, businesses, and communities. Committed to financial solutions and advice to support people and families. More information at laketrust.org.
So a petition campaign turned in more than 500,000 signatures on Wednesday. It's the controversial Let My, that's MI, Kids Learn initiative. It wants to extend tax credits to fund private school scholarships. This is a DeVos family-backed plan. If elections officials certify that the campaign has collected enough valid signatures, it could go straight to the legislature for an up or down vote rather than to the ballot. Clara, explain what this petition campaign would do, and then later we'll get to this whole bypassing of voters.
Sure. So it's a pretty simple idea. It's broken down into two separate proposals. The first would create a scholarship for families with students in K-12 to cover educational expenses, including private school tuition. And the second proposal would create a tax credit for those who contribute to that scholarship program. Opponents have likened it to a voucher scheme and say it's unconstitutional and we would defund public schools. I think it's important to note that Michigan Constitution does have a pretty firm and broad prohibition on public funding for private education. So the initiative, if adopted, would likely face a legal challenge. And the DeVos family has poured more than $4 million into funding the Let My Kids Learn committee. Organizers did miss an earlier filing deadline, so the required review of the signatures that they've submitted won't have to take place until after the midterm election. And given the fact that the Bureau of Elections is staring down a major general election and a couple of other constitutional amendments that have filed signatures, I don't think we'll see those signatures vetted before the end of the year or maybe even at the start of next year.
Zach, this is legislation, actually, that was pushed last year by Republicans, the majority, of course, in both the House and Senate, that Gretchen Whitmer vetoed. Talk a little bit more about why opponents are so against it. It's not just simply because, you know, the DeVos name is behind it.
Well, there's been a 50-plus year battle in Michigan about whether public money should be in some way directly or indirectly used to help people pay for the cost of non-public schools, private schools. 1970, voters adopted probably the nation's strictest prohibition on any direct or indirect support of public money for non-public schools. And that is what the long game here is. Let's just game this out for a minute. Let's presuppose for the moment that the legislature, this does get certified to the legislature and the legislature enacts it. It becomes law. The very next thing that will happen is some plaintiffs, public school groups or others, will challenge this in court. If the Michigan Supreme Court, let's assume again for the moment, remains with a Democratic majority, it probably overturns this and says it violates the Michigan Constitution. That's where I think what the next step is, the whole game, which is the DeVos's, the Michigan Catholic Conference, take this into the federal courts to challenge Michigan's prohibition on public money for non-public schools. They feel with the new U.S. Supreme Court, which has been overturning similar but not exactly types of prohibitions in other places around the country, that this is their chance to try to get the U.S. Supreme Court to throw out or at least significantly diminish the 1970 prohibition on public money to non-public schools. There's a long game here, and that's what it is.
Well, let's go back very quickly to the short game, which is, again, the bypassing of voters, something that absolutely is legal in Michigan, Lauren, right? Which is, this is a way to basically bypass voters, bypass a governor's veto. Can you quickly explain again what is so special about Michigan that this is a way that certain laws can be enacted?
Yeah, so Michigan has two paths to a ballot initiative, either a legislative amendment or a constitutional amendment. Now, if it's a constitutional amendment, it doesn't have anything to do with the lawmakers, it would go straight into the state constitution. So if the signatures get adopted, it goes to the ballot, voters can vote on it, etc. Now, a legislative amendment, if this it gets the prerequisite amount of signatures, it will first go to the legislature, which then has the opportunity to do an up-down vote on the initiative without having to get the governor's signature, as you suggested. So this has been used many times, often by often by conservatives who are looking to get around the need for a governor who has signaled that they would veto some of these plans. And that has clearly been the case with Let My Kids Learn. Similar legislation that went through the legislative process was vetoed by the governor, hence the signature collection process. Now, the other interesting thing about this is that if the legislature is adopting it, then voters don't necessarily get the chance to decide whether they would be interested in enacting this. So in that case, it's decided by the legislature and the, you know, the few hundred thousand people who supported it. In this case, they turned in a little over 500,000 signatures, and we've got millions of voters in the state of Michigan. So it's a really interesting process that I always get a lot of questions about when ballot initiatives come up. And that is the intent here, to get it to the legislature to consider.
Yeah, that's Lauren Gibbons
and
with Bridge.
Let's look at what.
Oh, go ahead, Zach. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you know, let's look at what Clara was saying. If the Bureau of Elections and Board of State Canvassers are not able to vet those signatures before the end of the year.
Yeah.
But let's say they do it early next year. Mm-hmm. It goes to the next legislature. And if the Democrats were to win control of just one house of the legislature, let alone both, they will not enact this. And it would end up on the 2024 ballot.
Right.
Which is a, you know, really interesting scenario to consider.
This is why we love you, Zach, because you come out and just continue to do the long game. Go ahead, Laura.
It is a very long game here.
So let's see. This is Lauren Gibbons, who we are talking to from Bridge, Michigan, Zach Gorchow from Gongra News Service, and Clara Hendrickson from the Detroit Free Press. I want to turn back to the courts, where the legality of abortion in Michigan currently rests. The enforcement of Michigan's 1931 abortion ban is blocked right now, temporarily. Right now, abortion is legal in Michigan, but the situation is tentative. And over the past few weeks since the Dobbs decision, it has been confusing in the state. This week, David Kallman, he's the attorney representing prosecutors who believe they have the authority to press charges against abortion providers. He subpoenaed Governor Whitmer to testify in her lawsuit against the 1931 law. But Clara, yesterday, a judge said she will not have to testify. Can you just bring us up to speed about all of these court machinations about the legality of abortion in Michigan right now?
Right. I mean, it really has been a flurry of legal activity that would make anyone's head spin. I know it's made my head spin. And I guess sort of the Cliff Notes version of where we're at is that, yes, yesterday, the subpoena calling on Whitmer to testify was quashed by an Oakland County Circuit judge. And next week, there will be a hearing after that same judge issued an emergency order barring county prosecutors from charging abortion providers to consider potentially issuing an injunction that would continue to bar county prosecutors from enforcing the state's abortion ban that is on the books. So I think the important perspective is that despite all of the sort of legal back and forth here, none of this may end up mattering that much in terms of the substance of the legality of abortions in Michigan, depending on whether or not a constitutional amendment lands on the November ballot, which would leave it up to voters to decide whether to enshrine abortion rights in the Michigan Constitution.
Thanks, Clara. This is the Reproductive Freedom for All. That's the ballot campaign that wants to enshrine, as you say, abortion rights into the state constitution. More than 750,000 signatures were turned in last month. Zach, we're still waiting for the Board of State canvassers to approve the petition to go on the November ballot, though.
That's right. Potential challengers to the petition signatures have until August 18th to challenge the validity of the signatures the Bureau of Elections will be looking at. And so we'll find out if anybody does file a challenge, and nothing can happen with the petition until then. Because of the record number of signatures that were submitted by Reproductive Freedom for All, it appears any challenge is probably a long shot. And even the opponents of this have hinted that it may not be worth the resources to challenge it. I'm sure they've been scrutinizing the sample. It's a little over, you know, it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 550 signatures or so out of this universe of 735,000, 40,000. I'm sure they're scrutinizing it. But the reality is they would have to find a lot of invalid signatures to knock this off the ballot. And we'll see if anybody does file that challenge. If not, things will move very quickly from there toward getting the 100-word ballot description done. This all has to be done in a matter of weeks. I think September 9th is the deadline for the Secretary of State to be getting all of that language to the county clerks as they get their ballots done. This all has to move very fast.
Lauren, last week there was, of course, the big vote in Kansas, where voters basically said, no, we want to continue the abortion protection that the state currently has. And that really kind of, I think, made many folks who may be for or against this proposal really kind of open their eyes to what this could mean for Michigan. And if, in all likelihood, as Zach said, Reproductive Freedom for All does make it onto the ballot in November here in the state.
Yeah, I think that's the big question going into the midterms, right? It's unclear exactly how this ballot initiative will impact turnout up and down the board. It could impact a lot of different races up and down the ticket. And it will be interesting to see the Kansas petition was knocking down an anti-abortion initiative. Mm-hmm. This would be asking voters to approve a pro-abortion initiative. I've been told by experts there is a bit of a distinction there, because asking voters to say yes is a little bit more difficult than asking them to say no. That said, we have seen a lot of interest in this, even in the signature collecting process. You know, seeing more than 700,000 signatures is pretty unusual for a ballot initiative. And after the Roe versus Wade decision came down, and you know, even as the draft decision was circulating, that was something that a lot of people were watching, and it prompted a lot of interest in this ballot initiative early on. So it does appear that there is motivation there. Now, the anti-abortion groups will fight very hard against this. We've already seen a lot of people talk about their concerns and their opposition. It obviously is diametrically opposite from the current state statute on the books that's currently working its way through the courts, as we've talked about. So there's a lot of people who are also very interested in this not making the ballot. So expect to see some strong opposition, as well as the abortion rights advocates really trying to get this before voters. I think there's a big question mark as to what this means for the rest of the midterms. We got a lot of really interesting races. Redistricting really reshaped the maps. So there's a lot of big question marks, and abortion rights is a huge factor.
Yeah. Well, as we wrap up, I want to continue in some other court news this week. Jurors heard opening statements on Wednesday in the federal retrial of Barry Croft and Adam Fox. These two are accused of plotting to kidnap Governor Gretchen Whitmer from her vacation house up north. They were going to hold her hostage, allegedly, and put her on some kind of trial for her handling of COVID-19. Zach, can you remind us just of this story that happened almost 2 years ago and really made national news headlines? This was a mistrial earlier this year because of a deadlocked jury. So this is a new trial.
Right. This really goes back to the this group of men that was accused, and some have pleaded guilty and cooperated. Others have been acquitted, and then we have the two here with the mistrial. This group of men that allegedly was preparing to kidnap the governor from her vacation home up north, staked out the place, did surveillance, real activities and plans that seemed to be pointing toward this type of attempt. But the defense attorneys were quite successful at the first trial in deadlocking the jury over whether this was simply a matter of freedom of speech, that this idea that it was tough talk, but these guys never intended to actually carry it out and didn't commit the crime they were accused of, that they talked about it. But in their view, unless they had actually attempted to kidnap the governor, no crime was committed, and the jury deadlocked on that point. So here we are now for round two on these two particular defendants. And I think we're already seeing a lot of the same arguments going forth. But I think we're also going to see the attorneys dig in that much harder. This was a big loss for prosecutors to get the mistrial the first time, and they're going to have to find a way to strengthen their case to convince a jury that this was more than just talk. And they certainly tried to show these were real actions, but they're going to have to do more. And the other thing they're going to have to work around too, and the defense attorneys will argue again, is entrapment. Mm-hmm. That was a big part of the defense, was that the FBI entrapped these guys. And so that's what's in play here.
Okay, you guys, we are going to have to leave it there for this Friday. Another huge news week here in Michigan and, of course, nationwide. I want to say a big thank you to our guest this hour, Zach Gorchow, publisher at Gongwer News Service, Clara Hendrickson, reporter at the Detroit Free Press, and Lauren Gibbons, Capitol reporter at Bridge, Michigan. Thank you all so much, you three.
It was fun. Thanks.
Yeah, thank you so much.
And that is Stateside for today. I am Zoe Clark. April Bear is back in the chair on Monday. Thank you so much for listening. Happy Friday.